Hey, everybody, just a quick note before we start the regular show today. I want to apologize right off the top of the bat for some bad audio quality just on the opening and closing song. My special apologies go out to Jonathan Mann, who kind of wrote our song. My little soundboard tablet had been, repurposed for the day, unbeknownst to me, and there were some quirks in what happened with some of the volume, so I want to apologize right off the top of the bat. But other than that, the sound quality is great, so, you know, stay in there, like, get past that first, whatever, a few seconds before we hit to the show. We had a great show tonight with Brian Bailey, so hope you enjoy it. Take care. This is Kevin Mahoney. Welcome to Raging Chickens Out to Cube Live. This is our call-in show for Monday, February 2nd, 2021. We had a little weird stuff on the sound on the intro there, so let's hope that doesn't carry into the show. I don't think it will, but anyways, welcome. On Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sort, right from our own backyards and from across the country. On Fridays, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics on our flagship show. But, you know, you can get both the live show, this show right now, Out to Coop Live, and our Friday show, all our podcasts, by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You can also make sure, if you're listening right now on our YouTube channel, head on over to our YouTube channel and make sure you smash that subscribe button. Make sure that you hit that little notification bell so every time that we go live that you're going to give you a notification and you can join us there too as well. But you can only join the conversation live by calling in through our Podbean app on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern. Of course, you can comment there. You can comment on our YouTube channel. But if you want to call in, you want to contribute to the conversation, this is the place to be. The show also streams live on our YouTube channel. And make sure that you get over there. And as I said, smash that subscribe button and hit that bell so you know every time we go live. And you can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show live on the Podbean app, you can show us some love right now. You can drop a few bucks in our tip jar by clicking on that little gift icon at the bottom of the screen. Fill your digital pockets with Podbean's golden beans. That's what they call them, everybody. And send us a gift of your choice. Every gift that you send helps support and expand this podcast. And if you're looking for more PA progressive talk, tune into the Rick Smith Show. You know, tonight and every night. Yeah, you know, it streams live at 5 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter, and Facebook account, pretty much everywhere he's on, it's where he streams on. Or you can subscribe to his daily podcast wherever you get your podcast. That's a Rick Smith Show. And a special shout out goes to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and to follow him on Twitter at @SongADayMan. That's @SongADayMan with two N's. And that's Jonathan Mann. And I hope this song came through a little bit on the intro because didn't sound so great on my end, but we shall see. We shall see, and I'll get that sound fixed at least for next week. So on today's show, I welcome back once again Brian Bailey to the podcast. Bailey is an assistant professor of rhetoric and composition at the University of Cincinnati's Blue Ash College. Brian's latest articles include Are We an Academic Journal? Editing as Ethical Practice for Change, co-authored with Steve Parks, and that can be found in Reflections, a journal of community-engaged writing and rhetoric. And the ever-timely piece, it would seem, this piece in Present Tense, a journal of rhetoric and society. He's got this piece called So, Richard Spencer is coming to campus, right? Or is coming to your campus. How is he allowed on, and how can you confront him? Right. There's been, I guess, some renewed interest of that out in Ohio. I've been seeing some of this online. So it's like the evergreen article, apparently, which is great. So I wanted to have Brian back on the show to update us on some of the many assaults on public higher education during the pandemic. Tonight, we're going to talk about, you know, attempts by lawmakers in Iowa to strip tenure from faculty in all public colleges and universities. And we'll also ask the question, why is there a dead professor teaching an art course at Concordia University? That's kind of interesting, right? But then, of course, the University of Florida installed tattle buttons so that students or anyone else could narc on faculty who decided that COVID was just too dangerous, so they moved some of their classes online. That has been some pushback on that, and they've since kind of like uninstall the panic or the tattle buttons. This is just a crazy story. And we'll also then in our own backyard here, we'll probably touch on this a little bit. The PA State System of Higher Education is gutting faculty and staff at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. That's a story that actually made it to the pages of the New York Times about how the pandemic is kind of coming down hard, especially on working class students and working class universities. But we won't leave you all with doom and gloom. We'll also talk about the fight back. UC students with Boldly Bankrupt are doing amazing work and building coalitions for the fight back. And you've heard some students right in our own neck of the woods who've been on our Out to Coop Live in the past couple of weeks who've been talking about what's happening at Kutztown University campus and other circumstances. So, Brian, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thank you for having me back again. I always like coming on this show.
Well, you know, like Brian and I were talking about before the show today, how these conversations that we have here, you know, before the show, we got the lobby, right? Just so you kind of coming on the show, it's the first time on the show, you know, that kind of open up the live show a little bit early, give a chance people to come in, and we just kind of are kind of chit-chatting around, just like you would, you know, like say there's a show, a concert, something like that. You're milling around the lobby ahead of time, kind of like that thing. Anyways, we were talking a little bit about this ahead of the show about just, you know, how it feels kind of like sane making, you know, to be kind of connected with other people that are, you know, going through this and you're kind of like-minded. And this is part of, you know, part of solidarity, part of the work of community and part of the work of just sustaining the kind of resistance. And you know, keeping the faith, because it seems like, you know, just, you know, even with Trump gone, right? Trump's gone, right? The daily barrage of the tweet storms are not here. But it still seems like there's like a never ending assault of, you know, against things public, against what's here, you know, and the fight back's good there too as well. So I'm glad you're here for that reason too, Brian.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I'd just like to start off by saying that I am, again, someone who agrees with Kevin in this idea of fighting back and pushing back. And I just wanted to go ahead and let folks know that on my campus, I'm what's called an AAUP associate. That's the union, the campus union there. And that basically means I'm a shop steward. And so I also don't claim to have all the answers. And I'm not even trying to advocate that the AAUP, which I love my union, but is the perfect union or is leading the way. I really just like you're talking about here with your intro is this idea that it's a collective effort. And it's through different, small tactics and actions and alliances you can make that things change and that it's most likely going to be changed. It's going to take some time. So I'm hoping we can talk about that as well and by talking about that and making that clear, I really want to stress that it's like we shouldn't be depressed or run down. I know that's hard. I know, especially during, you know, when a lot of us are in indoors for most of the time now, but it's a long fight and it's something that's going to take some time and we're going to have to pick up fellow travelers along the way.
You know, I'm glad to hear you put it that way because, you know, one of the things that I've found that's been most difficult in organizing during the pandemic is, you know, one, just the face-to-face stuff that is a normal part of organizing, a normal part of political engagement, normal part of, you know, our freaking jobs for that matter. But in this, I know that, you know, I mean, my union, which is ABSCUF, which is, you know, specific, it's an independent union of the state system of higher education universities. There's 14 universities at this point, although they're consolidating a bunch of them now, and which I'm sure is going to prove to be a disaster. But whatever, it's like, you know, normally the, you know, our union meetings and union communications that we would have, and we'd see this resistance, we'd see organizing among faculty and staff and students, and there's the appearance is there's less of that going on just simply because of the pandemic. And so, you know, it's also feeling disconnected from some of those mechanisms for organization. And I know that's got to be a struggle at, you know, even kind of union leadership level. And it's also got a lot of folks kind of rethinking or hitting a pause button, if you will, and kind of looking around and say, wanting to build some coalitions and build some more kind of organizing opportunities with students, with community members, with parents, in ways that are potentially has the power to kind of say reshape our unions and make them much more dynamic, and, you know, and kind of much more, in some cases, much more militant, because it'd be kind of connected to a power base that's not just about, you know, a service model of unionism. But, you know, I digress. But I mean, that's, you know, those things about, you know, that AAUP's model or kind of ABSCUF's models or any organization is not like, you know, this is the way, but rather seeing kind of like we're in a process of remaking, I think, of a progressive struggle.
I agree. And with that in mind, for folks who don't know, again, you know, Kevin and I are academics. That's our day job, I guess we can call it. We're all laborers. I mean, you know, especially those of us who teach React Comp, we feel like we're quite the laborer, I feel like a laborer anyways. And, you know, you know, I just want to get across everybody too, that while it may seem sort of pie in the sky, universities they're not run by hippies, and they're not inherently liberal. And they're also not inherently worried about students. So even though at times, you know, Kevin and I will go back and forth, and I don't want to think we're shutting people out of the conversation, but we actually talk about what we understand, which I think is good. I try not to talk about things I don't understand, or yep. At least I ask questions. But understanding that what we're experiencing in the university is also what's happening in American society in general, which is, you know, that the neoliberal models of how to run businesses, of moving public goods to private hands, of extracting funds from the public sector and from the public services, and trying to put that money in the hands of private holding, private corporations. So, you know, again, those myths that, you know, it's a bunch of hippies or liberals, or that they're inherently worried about students, are not true. So, for instance, at the University of Cincinnati, our board of trustees, which has like, I think, 13 or 14 people on it, only one has a background in education. The rest come out of the business world. And they were all appointed. So they're not even, and they get paid for the job, but they're appointed by a governor. And a lot of times it comes out as a favor or a thanks for helping a governor with their campaign. You know, so my point to get across here is that universities are exceptionally traditional institutions. The people who run the universities, they are traditional, and they're also business-minded. They participate in investing their endowments in various stock market schemes. That's why some of the Ivies lost money with the Great Recession and continue to lose money here and there every once in a while. They have several unethical business ventures, as I was talking about in the lobby. One of the things that state institutions have done, particularly state institutions, but even private institutions have done, is to become more like rental management companies, because student housing is not just an 8x10 student dorm anymore, but palatial luxurious apartments and all these amenities with gyms and, you know, you name it, anything that would make them a destination campus to get that high dollar student. They run that, and they have shady business, unethical business ventures often as well when they invest their money. So Kevin could probably tell you about his time at SU when he was a younger man, a young punk, so to speak, working against that.
Literally,
because I've seen the pictures in the Daily Orange. Yeah, that you were. I think you were working with divesting from South Africa, right? And the different sort of.
That's absolutely right. So, yep, absolutely
the
right.
The investment schemes that University administration had.
Yep, and wanted to push against the universities for its training in the ROTC program because we were sending soldiers to training some death squads in Central America. So that was kind of what you were saying. Yes, divestment. Absolutely.
All that stuff. Those are real things, right? And so, you know, they want to make money.
Yeah.
They also have this really amazing big belief. And we're talking again about administrators, that sports increases enrollment, although there is no actual hard data to do that. And as my colleague John McNay wanted to remind everybody that every year the University of Cincinnati loses about $30.4 million in the black hole that's known as their football program. You know, they really, the administrators and the board of trustees really believe that that is a good investment. On top of that, the foundation for most of the universities that we're a part of, even though we tend to be, or I think that Kevin and I are pretty ethical people, and most of my colleagues and most of Kevin's colleagues who I know and have met over the years are exceptionally ethical, good people. But the institutions themselves, I mean, especially at land-grant universities, this is land that was granted to these universities through the Morrell Act, which was basically taking any land that was taken away from indigenous Americans and basically given to whatever they wanted to do with it. So the federal government started giving out to universities, as well as a lot of university founders were slaveholders, and they made their money because with slaves, because that was a huge way to make money in the beginning of the country. So for instance, just to show I'm not casting stones, the University of Cincinnati was, one of the founders was Charles McMicken. He was a slaveholder. And much like Thomas Jefferson, had children with his slaves and had entire families that were off the books, but he took care of. And just recently, University of Cincinnati decided to remove his name from McMicken College of Arts and Sciences. So that's something they're grappling with, and there's an entire history project built around that, led by the professors in the history department at UC at all campuses. But so all those things go into factor. And so that's just to give some folks who may not know a lot about how higher ed works, a snapshot of why we talk so much about higher ed and why Kevin and I think it's important to relate to what we see going on. It's just a microcosm of all these other things that we're constantly talking about.
Right.
We get on, you know, podcasts, or we listen to our favorite podcasts, or we get into our favorite news feeds. It's just more intense because we can see it. You know, we can see the institutions, and we know the people pulling the levers.
Well, I would make a case here too as well, is that it's not just that we can see it. I think it's because, number one, we didn't get into this, say, you know, world in order to have budget battles, right?
Right.
I mean the discourse in this, in our country, in our culture, the discourse about what education is, right? What professors do, what happens in higher education, is so disconnected from the machinations of how people are making decisions from the administration. Like it took me a long time, right, to be able to flip my head around and basically to kind of read the institution differently. Right. I mean, I was one of these, you know, these kids that I went to college, and then I loved college. I loved ideas, and I thought people there were absolutely committed to it, like, you know, from top to bottom. Right. You know, that's what I thought. And then I was disabused of that at Syracuse pretty quickly. Right. But then over time, you know, you start learning that, hey, I went to school for God, crazy amounts of time. Right. I studied all this stuff with the intention of kind of furthering, you know, kind of understanding or practices or make a contribution into this particular area of scholarship and research and teaching, only to find out that I need to learn a whole other discourse to understand why my job suddenly feels like it's like under pressure, under attack, that I'm in crisis every single semester. And, you know, I talked about this on our podcast on Friday. Is like, you know, I've had so many questions from people about, you know, what happened at Kutztown and what happened at the Pasha. Somebody told me that you published about this stuff. And so I'm actually putting together this stuff in kind of like, you know, kind of a book form of just the story of what happened at Pasha, because, it, you know, in the state system of higher education, because it runs completely opposite the narrative that the chancellor is telling the public, that is telling, that presidents are telling parents, that they're telling politicians, you know, and then we're all on the receiving end of this stuff. And so, you know, what I've found over the years is that the more I begin to understand the kind of decisions that have been made and the kind of the corporate, not just business, but corporate mentality, like hedge fund mentality that's going in to higher ed, is that the more I find opportunities for alliance with people across the spectrum. Right. So, I mean, suddenly it's like it makes a hell of a lot more sense that we're making sure that we're reaching out, you know, not just to parents, but to, you know, people who are small business owners in our town, into, you know, to food service workers. Right. To every time that there's a strike in there, we should be there. You know, things like this, like building out that connection, because, you know, we might have in higher education, this is what I find, and I'll stop talking in a second, but in higher education, we find, I think there's a lot of folks that think, you know, that it's a step above, right? And so they try to keep this distance from everyone else. And I'm like, holy crap, man. It's like, it is not the case. It's like, you know, this is under assault just as much as any other institution, even if we're a little bit later to the game than what's happened to, you know, the decimation of other parts of our economy. But, you know, end diatribe for now.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And so, you know, that's one of the things, again, the destruction of what we have is, say, like any other industry, because it is an industry and that's basically what it's become. Mm-hmm. You know, like this first piece I wanted to talk about. So I call it
Teaching
from
this.
The Dead.
Exactly. Look, Brian, here's the thing is Brian is very often one of my like first lines of news when it comes to like stories that are going on in higher ed, because he's so on this stuff. And when this came across my feed that you posted, I'm like, Just stop. Just stop. But go ahead. Let's take us into it. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, again, if you were in the lobby, you heard my woes about having a child that loves to stay up till early in the morning, which one of the reasons I'm on top of these things is because I'm doom scrolling and I'm on Twitter. You know, because you can only go through a student work so many times. Eventually you run out of things to go over, you know, all that good stuff. And eventually just get tired of doing work and you've got to switch your brain off. So I doom scroll and I came across this really late at night, and a student I found out named Aaron, and I'm going to mispronounce his last name. So Aaron, if you ever hear this, I apologize. I believe it's Ansunui. It's, it's spelled A-N-S-U-I-N-I. He began tweeting that he was trying to get a hold of his art professor because he really enjoyed this class. It was online. He was really getting interested in the class. He wanted to speak directly to his professor, who is named Francois-Marc Gagon, I believe is how the professor's name was pronounced. You know, that he wanted to talk to him.
I was getting pretty pissed off they weren't getting responded to, right?
Yeah, and so he was like, I can't get a hold of him. And then I found out why. One of his teaching assistants finally got back to me and said, he's dead. He's been dead. This class is being taught through the videos and the lectures he recorded before he died. And myself and one other teaching assistant, we've been grading all of your work. We've taken on all of his courses that are online, and they explained the situation and said, you know, we can answer your questions. But the student himself, while he was pleased that someone got back to him eventually, you know, that's the whole thing. If you start thinking about how everyday people now are expected to work and to continue to work, it's as if the pendulum swung back to the 19th century. We've got now professors teaching from the dead. And it comes down to this idea of IP rights. And so it's, you know, intellectual property. And they have claimed, Concordia University out of Montreal, Canada, has claimed IP rights on all of the professor, the departed professor's work. So peace be upon him. Condolences to his family. But he lives on through the university, and the university is still making money on him because, again, thinking about the university as a business, not as some place that's different and separated from the world, the material real world, they collect tuition dollars from this professor's classes. And classes, if you don't know much about the university, is the cheapest way for a university to make money, because the buildings are up, everybody's professors are paid for ahead of time, right? They've got their different sorts of salaries and everything already hashed out. They have their own physical plants, their own power, their own sewage. They run everything almost always separately from whatever city they're a part of, even if they're located in a city. Yep. Right? They may not be a downtown urban university. And so the cheapest way is to teach classes. And it's even cheaper when you're doing things online. Like this class is asynchronous and online because of the pandemic. And so, you know, they are basically literally making money off of this professor. And so there was also, I started digging around, and there's a great article on slate.com. It's by, Tamara Neese, and her last name is spelled K-N-E-E-S-E. And her article was called How a Dead Professor is Teaching a University History Art Class. And she's got some great background on it. She's got some really neat stuff. I also have a link, to the original series of tweets. I'm sure Kevin will put them in the show notes if you actually want to see the Twitter, post that Aaron, the student who discovered the death of, or his professor was dead, if you want to see it for yourself. She has a great article, though, as well, going back to Tamara, who was writing about this particular event. And one of the things that she points out is that to make more money, universities could decide and are deciding to release large-scale versions of their existing classes, and they're targeting wider demographics. They can and could and are repurposing all the previous digital lectures and online content that faculty have created. And, you know, this is something that is on the horizon. It's obvious that it's happening. Montreal or Concordia University is obviously doing it already. And here in the States, we've got places like Purdue University, right, who has that IP setup, that intellectual property right contractual agreement with its professors. And they are now moving that direction. So basically, they've adopted, Tamara Neese says, Purdue University adopted a new IP model that makes it possible for the university to maintain rights to courseware designed for distance or e-learning, even if the faculty member leaves Purdue. And so you get into this really strange concept where the product being made, right? So that's always a basic idea of value, right? And the product is moving away from the person, the labor who makes it. And, you know, the value is basically extracted by how much it can be sold for. And correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, I'm not up on my marks.
Yep.
But at the same time, now what we're seeing is not only that, but even the use of that product that's created through labor. And so you're seeing it now being implied in particular ways where the professor no longer has control over it. He, she, they has no say in how the course is taught or what's cut or what's revised or the scheduling. It's now just become the universities. And that, I think, is something that really speaks to the direction the university is moving, where they want that setup where they've got the zombie professor.
Yep.
And a bunch of, you know, graduate students, if they can get them, because you know, almost no place will allow graduate students to organize, so that they can just grade the work and give the feedback for the students.
Right. And what you get in that kind of scenario is that you get a situation where, okay, if you're going to hire faculty at all, you might hire them kind of coming in, you hire a more limited number of faculty members, and you hire them, say, for example, on a 2-year stint, right? And part of that stint is to come in and deliver, quote unquote, these courses. Right. So they're delivering the courses and then that's all being recorded and then they go on. Right. Then they're kind of, you know, they're fired or their contract is up and they move on. But those courses remain. And so then say just for sake of argument, then you take like the next 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Right. And all you're doing is basically replaying that package of lectures, those package of courses that were already delivered. And that is just kind of free money for the university. Meanwhile, you have like, you know, literally like graduate students like laboring in the basement, right, sitting online mm-hmm. and responding to all these chats and everything. And what struck me so much about this instance of at Concordia University is the fact that the students had no idea. Right. Because it's one you can imagine a scenario, and I'm not a proponent of this. Let me be clear. But you can imagine a scenario where students were aware of how that was working. Right. That they were going to be delivered these packages of courses by, you know, whatever famous faculty members who were once here. Right. But mm-hmm. in this case, you had the contract, right, if you want to put it in these terms, between the student and the university that they're going to be taking a class with actually faculty members. And to have the surprise of not only is that faculty member not there, but that faculty member is dead, right, is astonishing. Yeah. And, you know, I remember back in, you know, I remember Jim Zabrowski, okay? You know Jim Zabrowski, right? You know Jim?
I know who he is. Yeah, okay. He was gone by the time I got there.
Right. So Jim is down at the University of Houston now, I believe. And Jim Zabrowski, he was one of my kind of mentors. He was on, you know, my committee. One of my most important mentors, I think, at Syracuse University, was there for a master's thing. Was Seth Kahn, good friend of ours. Seth Kahn's dissertation director. And I remember having this conversation with Jim when he was mad at his computer, as I like to always say to him at the time, at one point. And he and I were actually reading. We're doing an independent study reading Marx's Capital that summer. And he was mad at his computer. And we got talking about this, and he said, I was the last holdout to get kind of a computer on my desk for this. And I'm like, you know, I'm thinking like, oh, you know, what are you, a Luddite? You know, kind of like, what, you just got to get the technology? Right. And he said, no, he said, because the reason why they're putting the computer here is because they want us to answer all of our own emails, and therefore putting the kind of secretarial staff out of jobs. Right. And that's how Jim always thought. Right. He's always thinking about the kind of relationship of labor. And this is exactly this kind of case where they're extracting the labor. Right. They're kind of taking, you know, and alienating kind of the producers of it from the actual content of it, and then selling it out as a commodity. I mean, it's really astonishing. And, you know, I remembered when there was first of all, you know, when you're talking about intellectual property rights. I mean, that's the kind of thing that, you know, for most people, they hear, you know, your intellectual property rights when you put something up on D2L or whatever kind of learning platform you have. And that's the kind of thing that I think most, especially newer faculty, look at that and think, okay, my brain is going numb, my eyes are glazing over, I'm going to pay attention to something else, right? And yet, those fights are we're seeing the kind of fruits of those fights, right? And who's winning those fights at this point? Through these kind of stories, so
right, and that's the thing is the IP, you know, licensing that's involved when you go on with a learning management system like D2L or Canvas or Blackboard. It's just like if you've ever played an MMORPG, you know, if you played WoW, World of Warcraft, or if you can go way back and you played something like EverQuest, EQ, or even
look at you dating yourself. Oh,
I know, right? Lineage was out at one time, Final Fantasy IX, any of those, right? And yeah, absolutely. Now I feel old. But anyways, you know, that's like the EULA agreement, right? You just click through it because it's like, I'm not going to read all of this. And nobody really does expect you to read that. And that's basically what's happening is this is where that labor is being commodified and turned into a commodity that you no longer even have touch with, and you profit nothing from, you know, it was all of your time and effort. And, you know, amazingly, Jim was right. I mean, even now, as you said that, I'm sitting here looking at my laptop that my campus gives me because I'm supposed to take it home with me.
Right.
You know, and so I'm
that
always
was once a secretary.
Yeah. And exactly. Yep. Well, even at say like at UC, like if, you know, at the University of Cincinnati, I teach at Blue Ash College, which is a regional college, and it's a bit different than the center, or what I like to call the mothership campus, which is Clifton, which is what people imagine when they think of the University of Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. But at Blue Ash, when I first got there, I was really impressed by the fact that every department had an administrative assistant, right? What would have been in the past called a secretary, that job position anyways. And since I've been there, because they've rolled out so heavily with making sure everybody has portable devices, and because it was in the name of efficiency and of saving money, you've got now administrative assistants like ours in particular, who is a wonderful, lovely woman, whose name is Amber Kuftik. She is like the administrative assistant for like four different departments, and she rotates throughout the week to the different departments. Now, she spends a lot of time in my department, which is English and Communications, because we're one of the largest departments on campus.
Right.
So she's there quite a bit. But, you know, when you think about the working arrangements because of the technology, it's supposed to have been making it easier for us. And what it's done is it's actually removes people from the workforce. You know, and that's just something that, again, I think Jim was obviously much more awake than you and I were.
Totally. I mean, I remember at that point being like, oh, my God, computers, like, thank God. Let me get one as soon as possible so I don't have to type it on my, like, Smith Corona freaking, like, manual typewriter or something like this. And, you know, and so, and again, and that it doesn't, that doesn't mean that the computer, and Jim's whole point was all this, like, look, the computer is not the enemy here, right? It's like, it's the expectations and the relationship that's built into that technology, right? And that it's the relationship mm-hmm. that's embedded in there, because there's no reason, like, say, for example, like, my job could be much more effective with a computer if I did it with a computer as opposed to not having a computer on my desk, right? But mm-hmm. the expectations of then what that means, right? About therefore am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to be staying atop, like on top of, and all this stuff? Am I supposed to be answering all this stuff, which was once performed by labor? There's no necessary reason for that, right? It doesn't have to be that way, but nonetheless, that's what it is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I mean, that story just really just blew my mind. So it really just blew my mind. But so let me, I mean, not to switch too quickly away from this, but you know, it seems also connected with this same kind of these kind of developments, especially as we're having, you know, this pandemic. And I think that there are certain folks in the higher education kind of industry who are looking at the pandemic and, you know, kind of through kind of Milton Friedman eyes here. They're looking at it as this is an opportunity to actually kind of one destroy the power that does exist among faculty to control the direction of higher education, and to remake it in their own images, right? I mean the industry's images. And we're seeing this, and again, this is one of these stories that you flagged, right? From you saying, hey, if you think this is just Iowa, right, it's coming to you real soon. So can you take us through a little bit what's going on kind of in Iowa, and particularly this kind of attack on tenure?
So, okay, just a little bit, just to back up a bit, just for some context. This is the third year that Iowa has had an attack on tenure happen. And so, let's see, every year since 2018, that means there have been different versions of this bill to remove tenure from the state schools in Iowa under consideration in both the Senate and the House. So you're looking at two different bills at once, constantly hitting. And so let's see, it's Senator Brad Zan, who is a Republican out of Urbandale, who has proposed bills in 2018, 2019, and this year. The concept here is that they want to get rid of tenure because they want to make faculty more responsive to the public, and to public concerns and to lawmaker concerns.
So I heard like quotes around about every other word in that sentence that you just said, right? Responsibly. No, but you know what I mean? I mean, seriously, I mean, like, and this is kind of like the language of these bills, right? Kind of, what does responsive mean? Right? Who is the public that is imagined in that kind of responsiveness? What are the issues that seem to be at the forefront? And then as you kind of close that sentence out saying, and to the ones of lawmakers, right? Because I think that's where there's the blurring of the lines in here. You have these, say, Republican, kind of increasingly right-wing Republicans, right, who have this particular agenda that are substituting words like the public for their own agenda. Right, their own issues that they have, and the people that are their direct constituents that are keeping them kind of there in power.
Absolutely, I agree, and that's one of the things is that when I was looking up this, and I was basically doing some light research, I got a story out of the Gazette, which comes out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, in Iowa, from an article written by Vanessa Miller, in that she writes, when asked what is driving the push among some lawmakers to eliminate tenure, Willer cited a string of free speech and constitutional controversies across Iowa's public universities in recent months and years, like at Iowa State in August, where a professor syllabus barred students from submitting material opposing things like Black Lives Matter, same-sex marriage, and abortion. And then she quotes Willer saying, I think that there's a very strong concern with many in the state of Iowa about what's taking place on college campuses. He goes on to say, I think in general, the trust in our academics being free and fair is not quite there right now. And so just a couple things about this, like you were saying, like, first off, it's a small sample. He cites one sort of hearsay sort of example, right? Classic Trump move. You know, a lot of people say there's a problem in Iowa.
Okay, a lot of people say, people, lots of good people this. Say, they say it to me all the time. I get phone they calls. Say it to,
yes, exactly. Yeah. So who's saying this, right? And then it's this sort of general, it's every sort of boogeyman that the conservative right in this country is afraid of. Suddenly it's saying like that they're not being allowed to talk about these things. So, I mean, that's specious to begin with. But what I would also like to point out, and maybe some folks don't, again, if you're not in academia, you may not realize this, but state schools since the Great Recession, so I think we're now looking like way back when in 2007, 2008, like they have, most states across the country have severely reduced the amount of money they give to any of their state schools. That is why tuition is skyrocketing at your local state school. Even if it's a two-year campus, a community college, a regional campus, whatever. It's not because Kevin and I are suddenly rolling in dough, like we're making six figures. We don't. I make now with raises for after being here for 6 years and studying forever, I make about 60 grand a year. It's not chump change, but it's not exactly 6 to 7 to 8 figures either. I'm not Coach Luke Fickell, coach of the UC Bearcats. He's the football coach, by the way.
Right.
He's making $3.4 million. But what ends up happening is with that amount of money going down, in some cases in the single-digit percentages that comes out of state budget going to state schools, all you end up getting is like 8-9% going. And that means that all of that is passed to the student. That's why the tuition skyrockets. And so it's always, I find really strange when lawmakers take it upon themselves to say, like, I'm concerned. Really, you're concerned? Because you're not paying very much. And the students are the ones, if they have a concern, should be the one registering the concern, right? They should be saying something, doing something, pushing back. So this is all very convenient cover. Because again, the argument against tenure, much like we just said earlier with the zombie professor, to remove tenure ensures that professors are at-will employees. So he, she, they does not have any academic freedom, cannot talk about things that are controversial, cannot perform any type of research that may offend certain sensibilities within the campus community or the larger community around them. And when you have that, there's no way for people who are working in the university to actually create knowledge and to disseminate the knowledge that they're getting from their research, from their experimentation. So this is all cover. And that's what really irks me is it's constantly, this is the cover to remove tenure, when really what they're saying is we just don't want people to feel comfortable, and we certainly don't want particular ideas that are troubling out there being spread on what they think is, you know, for the legislators, they think for whatever reason it's their money and not taxpayer money.
Exactly.
So, you know, I'm just always sort of, you know, I'm always flummoxed by that. And I wish that it would just be, there would be a moment where someone would challenge one of these lawmakers and say like, hey, wait a minute, how much are you paying state universities? Are you really a stakeholder? It's classic, like just, you know, snap, break, smash, and then you can just hire in anybody at a lower rate. And he even goes on to say this, the people interviewed in the interview talk about how people are still going to come to Iowa and work no matter what. Because because other people interviewed had said, like, you know, this would be a problem. People would leave this particular school. And it happens, and it does happen. So the University of Wisconsin-Madison was, like, this huge, like, crown jewel in the American academy
right. When
it came to all types of research. And since when Scott Walker was the governor and broke all those unions and literally curtailed academic freedom through the state constitution, they lost so many faculty that were considered really important to their fields. And while it may not mean a lot to you, that also means that their ranking as an institution went down. And since so many people do tend to see with that sport mentality of like, it's a competition, my state school versus your state school, that's how state schools start to lose standing, you know, is that they lose their faculty. It doesn't matter about the administrators. It's like what ends up losing standing a lot among state universities is who's there, who's working there in the classes with students, who's doing research there, you know, and this is how it starts. But that's because these folks are so short-sighted. They just don't think of things that way. They want to have labor working as cheaply as possible, just like every other industry now in the United States. And if they could, I'm sure they would offshore, or they would let your professor die and then, you know, just have a student, grad student teaching the class.
Right. Right.
I got a question here about what percentage of that budget goes to higher ed.
Yeah, I just responded to that. So I don't have that figure right. I'll see if I can come that out. But I'll tell you right now is that it's decreased dramatically since like the 1980s. It used to be the case that students and their families used to pay about 25%, 30% of the total costs involved with education. That was back in the 1980s when the system was first kind of brought together and founded as a one state system. And now those numbers are flipped. So now students and their families are responsible for about 75% of the total cost of their education. And Pennsylvania now has the second, depending on how you figure it, the second or third largest percentage of student debt in the country. And a lot of that is surprising. If you look at the debt coming out of the state system of higher education, it's extraordinarily high, even compared to some other state system universities. So, the funding for higher education in the state has been cut like, you know, yearly. And this is not just as, you know, this is, you know, a bipartisan agreement, right? You know, Democrats and Republicans alike have taken part in the kind of, you know, the anti-government, all taxes are bad, nothing for the public, everything for me. So that's been part of it. I mean, if you looked at what I give you this one kind of point of comparison where I got to look this up because basically I got to look at what the exact numbers is, because what happened in one of the more recent budgets is the money that used to go for higher education, right, was flip-flopped with and kind of put to the prison system, right? So you almost had like a one-to-one point of comparison where you had the prisons getting an increase by the same kind of percentage and dollar amount, actually, than the higher education got a decrease, right? So it was a direct one-to-one swap on the school to prison pipeline, right? So, you know, we'll see. I'll see if I can track that down before the end of the show, just to get back to that, because it's, you know, good to know for the percentage of budget.
One last thing I'd like to add really quick, though, about this is whenever anybody wants to break tenure, the other thing that they'll bring up, which wasn't brought up this time in Iowa, is that they're trying to keep everybody productive. And so what they're saying is they want to weed out the deadwood, right? They don't want people just getting tenure and then sitting back on their laurels and collecting a paycheck. But the problem is with doing that is that becomes this bureaucratic nightmare. So ironically, the government or the party of small government, when they start to advocate for these things, what they're doing is they're taking the control out of departments and colleges and administrators, because there's a huge chain of how people are just given tenure, right? It's not just given. It's like you have to go through and be reviewed, and you've got to have observations, and experts come in and testify from outside of campus about your ability to add to the overall scholarly conversation, all this good stuff. That's stuff that, if you're not an academic, probably bores you to tears. However, what you do want to think about is what that means then is that the government is deciding that what's productive and what's not. And that becomes this bureaucratic nightmare where you suddenly have to have these new institutions and these new committees at the state level who are looking for and basically acting as the inquisitors, of productivity. Which is just really odd for a party that supposedly believes in small government, that they suddenly want to add these sort of committees and install them when there are already apparatuses and places in these institutions to take care of all of this. So it's really strange, again, it's just this way to sort of break this and to make it as cheap as possible and be able to use plug and play and turn folks into robots and use zombie professors.
Absolutely. Right. And I think, you know, just I like to say this every opportunity I get a chance to do, just to underscore this point, like when we're talking about tenure, right, what tenure is. I mean, tenure is, you know, is due process. That's it. Right. It's the idea is that, you know, what Brian used the word before, wants, you know, what seems to happen in Iowa wants to be turning everything into at will employment, is basically that you can get fired for no reason. Right. So like in Pennsylvania, we're kind of an at will place. So, if somebody doesn't like my hair color, doesn't like my personality, doesn't like, you know, kind of the music I listen to, they can fire me. And that is perfectly legal under state law. Right. They can't fire me, like discriminate against me because, like, you know, I'm an African-American or that I'm a woman. But you know, because that's protected under kind of a constitutional amendment. But, you know, they just don't like who I am. They don't like my personality. They don't like my, like I said, you know, the tone of my voice. They can fire me and I don't have to worry about it. What tenure does is, like what happens in a lot of other states that are not at will, is basically say, okay, if, you know, after a certain period of time, right, if you're going to fire me, it has to be for cause. It has to be for a reason, right? Not just because you don't like me or you've decided that you want to do something else. Right.
Yeah, and that's a big thing too, is when it comes to those projects, again, that may force people not to like you. So say you work someplace that has black mold all over, and you decide to start documenting it and doing studies about how it's unhealthy for everybody who has to go into that building every day, students, faculty, staff, guests, whatever, right?
Yep.
You know, that's what the tenure does, is it provides that shield to say, like, this isn't right and no one's fixing it. And so another example of a health issue would be, for instance, like, you know, faculty working all the way in Virginia Tech, they were one of the first people who started telling the Americans that there are problems with lead in Flint, Michigan, because they started testing the water. Now, if they didn't have academic freedom, if they weren't protected by a tenure, you know, that they could have been run out of their job, because it's, you know, maybe a member of the board of trustees or maybe an alumni who has some hand in what's going on in Michigan doesn't like that, a big alumni donor. You know, before the establishment of tenure, they could have been run off for telling the truth and saying there is a health crisis in Flint, Michigan, which, by the way, is still happening.
Right.
You know, but, you know, that in everything going on there with lead, without tenure, those researchers, those academics would not have been able to do that and to publicly announce their findings.
100%. Well, I want to take everybody up. First, I want to say big thanks to kind of Whatev 2070 for kind of dropping in the gift. We appreciate it so much. And it's just an opportunity to remind you that, hey, if you want to help support this show, you want to keep it going and expanding like we've been doing over the past several years, you can become a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Or you can show us some love, just like Whatev 2070 just did, right? By hitting that little gift icon at the bottom of your screen and kind of, you know, put a little in our tip jar. Like, every gift that you send helps support and expand this podcast, and it goes right into making sure that we can deliver homegrown progressive media and keeping the media in the movement in the media, right here and Out to Coop podcast from Raging Chicken Press. So we're going to get to, if there's folks that want to put some messages down in there, you got any questions for kind of any, like either me or for Brian, it'd be great. And I definitely want to move into some of the, I promise you that we wouldn't end on doom and gloom, right? So we'll see if there's any kind of like anything you want to wrap up with this thing that's going on in Iowa, right? And then I want to hear about, you know, talk a little bit about what's happening. If you've been listening to the podcast at all, when Brian's been on before, I've been talking about this student-run organization called Boldly Bankrupt, and they're kind of building out this coalition, and talk a little bit about what's actually happening at kind of UC and the model that is kind of being built there. So Brian, I don't want to kind of like cut off the conversation too good, but is there anything else you kind of want to kind of throw in about what's going on in the Iowa situation before we talk about what's happening at UC?
Hey, if anybody listening is in Iowa, you need to start talking to your state reps and just point out the irony of what they're trying to do, considering they're the party of small government, as well as, like, you know, just ask them, like, are you really that concerned about education? Because I'll bet you a dime to a nickel it's less than a double-digit percentage of the state budget's going to any of the state schools in Iowa.
Absolutely. 100%. And then I think if I can get this stuff in the show notes, I want to, you know, talk about the percentage of the budget for higher ed and PA. If I don't get a chance to do it after show, I was just looking up trying to grab it quick now, and I don't want to kind of just get kind of go down some hole of numbers while I'm trying to run a show. So I'll kind of look for that afterwards and put some stuff in the show notes, or maybe follow it up on next week's show. But definitely, I can't tell you, in Pennsylvania, this goes to Whatev 2070. Once again, the question is, do the budgets for higher ed include the salary of the sports and coaches? In most cases, I think they do, yes. Right. It depends if you're talking public or private. I know that there's some public schools that have some percentage of the salaries that might come from outside fundraising. But yeah, I mean, that's part of the budgets.
I'd also like to point out, and I'm glad you asked this question, Whatev 2070, that in the last show I was on, our last episode I was on here at Raging Chicken at Out the Coup, Out the
Out Coup the
podcast. Sorry, man.
Just trying to make things difficult for the world. That's it.
That's right, man. Tongue twisters for the win. The coach who I mentioned earlier is a passing jab, probably not too clearly. Coach Luke Fickell is the football coach here at the University of Cincinnati. He was making about 1.5 to 1.7 or $1.7 million a year. The university decided they wanted to keep him. They turned his contract to a $3.5 million a year contract. And because it's gone beyond what they actually can budget for him, and this happened during a pandemic, by the way, when a bunch of us in the faculty took cuts to our various funds to try to help out the university during COVID. They actually, because they went beyond what they had budgeted for his salary, they actually started fundraising. They have connected with alumni donors and reached out to other places to fundraise for the coach's salary. And I'd like to point out that UC is not in a Power 5 conference. In fact, they had a wonderful season. So I completely support the student athletes who are on the team. They had a great season, but because they're not part of a Power 5 conference, they weren't even in the discussion about playing for the national championship because they're what's considered the other five conference, or one of the other five conferences. So, you know, the logic even of doing it seems sort of weird if the purpose is to win and get a national championship, but the system's already set against you to not be able to do that. Why even pay that amount of money? What's the point? Are we a minor league football team? Is that what we're doing? Is we're developing talent for the NFL, coach and player? I just find it strange. But yeah, it usually is included. But here at UC, they've gone one step beyond, to quote the old song lyric, and they are now fundraising to keep the coach here at UC.
That's great. And Brian, we got a question here from John that wants you to talk about Senate Bill 5 that was introduced 10 years ago today. What a anniversary. And this was later repealed by the people of Ohio by public referendum, a huge union victory. It is why we don't look like Mississippi with ice. So, yeah. So you got someone who wants you to talk about Senate Bill 5. Can you do that?
Yeah. Okay. So that was before I got to Ohio, but
That was actually five. Part Senate Bill 5, right? That was 2011, if I remember, or 2011, if I remember that right. Right. On the tail of after what happened in Wisconsin. This was one of the bills that was floated as part of the Tea Party victory in the midterms. And one of the reasons why Raging Chicken started, right, was part of this whole deal. Yeah.
Yeah. And so first off, just let me plug my colleague, John McNay.
Hey, John.
Who actually wrote a great book about this. And so if you ever get a chance, it's called The Battle of SB5, if I remember correctly. And what it would have done is it would have removed any sort of union collective bargaining, right? It would limit the collective bargaining for public employees. It would have prevented us from charging fair share dues. And it basically, for all intents and purposes, what it would have done is it would have gutted public service unions in the state of Ohio. So this is something that comes out of good old Alec. Koch brother funded, and that was what the Koch brothers wanted when they were taking that attack to unions, again, to privatize all the public goods. And they literally wrote the bill and passed it on to then Governor Kasich. And even early drafts of the bill still had like the Alec headers on it. The Republicans in Ohio's. Yeah, in Ohio, we're passing it around, and it's still got they didn't even have the chance or even the wherewithal to clean it up and try to make it look as if they wrote it. And so it was a union-busting bill is all it was. And the reason, and this is probably the more upbeat stuff that we can start getting towards, is the reason it fails is because you have all these public sector unions come together, AAUP being one of them. My union, which I was not yet a part of at the time, I think I was a member of Adjuncts United at Syracuse University. AAUP was on the forefront of that and really challenging that out there, demonstrating, working together, going across different union boundaries and saying, hey, we've got to do this. We're all in this together or we're all going to swing. We are going to lose everything with anything and everything that we hold dear. in keeping these jobs and having these jobs and being able to support ourselves, to have, you know, benefits, to have due process. And it's through all of the various unions coming together that they basically crushed this by voter referendum, that they got rid of it. They created a campaign that was both political. You had folks like John McMay, my colleague at UCBA, who was going up to the state Senate and the state House and was testifying. You had people making pleas online through, you know, Twitter and Facebook. And you had folks who were out there talking it up, educating, doing teach-ins on campus, as well as, you know, educating their neighbors, talking about stuff, getting into the local news. And it's through that massive, you know, creating that ally network that this was turned back. And, you know, again, it's great. It's a great, I didn't realize it was the anniversary. So thanks for pointing that out. You know, I should probably do something special for it because
I'm going to have a stout. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have a stout after the show. That's going to be my, like, it's apologize that anybody's got kids around, but that's my, like, fuck you to the bastards who tried that Senate Bill 5. That's what I'm, that's going to have my stout for tonight. So fantastic. So, like, yes, actually, exactly. John has kind of put this just in the notes, right? The We Are Ohio. I remember I love the shirts for that. I mean, it was such a great kind of mobilizing campaign. And that's what gets the good. So let's talk a little bit about what's happening at UC right now. Let's talk about kind of, like, you know, AAUP, right, is kind of now working with Boldly Bankrupt, right, as part of this this kind of coalition, this kind of building this kind of momentum and organizing on campus. So kind of walk us through what's happening these days.
So what's happening now is that we've got Boldly Bankrupt, which is a student-run organization I've talked about in the past when I've been here. If you could put that in the show notes and the link to their website.
Yep.
What they're really pushing, and they're working with the AAUP, is the 51% campaign. And so what we're trying to do together is to say we want UCD spending 51% of its budget on the education mission, the educational mission, and therefore education in general. We want the money going back into classrooms, back into the different sorts of things that are purely educational, because right now we're at, I think, about 45 to 46% of the budget is being spent on the educational mission. And so one of the things that Boldly Bankrupt is doing is they are actually pushing it's called Show Me the Money, I think is what they're calling it, but it's basically a receipt. They want a receipt to see, like, where does their money go? Because again, students end up paying for all these new sort of projects, whether it's to become to put in new buildings and to become landlords, essentially, and property management companies, whether it's to have great sports teams or at least well-funded sports teams, and with state budgets, you know, constantly pulling money back, not giving money to universities, students are paying for this. And so it's called Where's My Receipt? Fight for the 51.
51, yeah.
Yeah. And so when you can look at the ask that they have, if you click the link, and really it's a memo that basically says they want accountability. They're pointing out things that, you know, that there's patterns of spending coming from the administration aren't reflecting the priorities of what should be an educational institution. It's become really apparent during the COVID-19 pandemic. As the adjustments brought on, because of the pandemic, going online, not going on campus, not having a bunch of services are not reflected in their tuition bills. And so really what they're asking for is they want transparency. They want to know where the money is going, and they want accountability, right? They want to make sure that the money is allocated to the university and its colleges. And so they actually did this. They got this going. They sent this out. And eventually they did actually have a response. So they were able to meet with Bob Ombach, who's a senior VP of finance, and the provost, Christy Nelson, on December 2nd. And so they are set up for a follow-up call in January. And again, I think that first meeting, from what I remember and listening to it, much like the meeting that your student activist group at Cutsdown had, was one of those things where they're sort of, you know, the administration's kind of pushing it off and trying to, you know, flat hand them, or as well as like get out of there as quick as possible.
Right.
But what's important is that the students doing this realize that they can't do it on their own. And they're actually making this coalition, and they've got everything set up. So you can, one, have information at their website. You can check it out. I totally recommend it. Completely student-run organization. But they're also reaching out. They themselves are saying, we need students, we need parents, we need faculty, we need alumni. And they have a checklist of what you can do and places you can go and how you can help them hold the administration accountable. And so this is one of the ways that the AAUP is reaching out and working with students, right, to make them part of that process of saying, you know, we need an institution that focuses on the educational mission, not on sports, not on the idea of being a destination campus, not a property management company, but an institution concerned about students, concerned about education, concerned about making its education as affordable as possible, concerned about providing the best quality education possible, and making sure that the colleges within the university have what they need to run, to just run the daily business, right? And a lot of this is connected to, and I've talked about before in the show, is performance balanced budgeting, which is essentially, I mean, as we've talked about, and if you've got children around, you may want to turn it down. Budgets are bullshit, right? Mm-hmm. Budgets are an example of values. Budgets are socially constructed. And performance balanced budgeting essentially is, it's a loan shark game. And what they're saying is, we give you this arbitrary number, you have to make this amount of money. If you don't make the money, the central revenue flow will give you a quote unquote loan, right? And then you owe us. But the problem is the juice is always running, just like a loan shark. So formerly McMicken, now just the College of Arts and Sciences at UC, has had a down year. He got one of these, for lack of a better term, loans. And has still, even since then, even though their FTEs have been super high and they've been packed, has never gotten out of the hole. So what ends up happening is it's that extension of disaster capitalism, that extension of neoliberalism, where they're saying, well, then you need to cut. It's all about austerity.
Right, exactly.
And so you've actually got, like, they're cutting administrative assistance, they're cutting supplies, they're cutting, you name it, anything they can cut, they get rid of. And so you've got a department that isn't able to function because you literally have gutted it, that it can't function, right? There's nobody there in the department. The administrative system is gone or doesn't exist or is going between places. There are no supplies. You know, so you've got this sort of planned, destruction of a system. And at the same time, they then say, well, okay, we can go outside the campus and go outside the university and get partnerships, which is great if you teach, or you're a department that does something that corporations want, because really what they're saying is go out and get money in corporations. So all this stuff, again, is something that, the AAP has been very aware of, and now the students are aware of, and this is one way that we're trying to build those coalitions. By reaching out and saying, like, look, we are in the same boat as you. Our workplace is your educational experience. Let's do this together. And at the same time, let's constantly keep stretching out. Let's constantly use our different connections and let's reach our different demographics we can touch so we can create that larger alliance that's going to be needed to take on an institution that never sleeps, never stops,
right,
and has a full staff dedicated just to the bottom line.
Right. And I also think what this speaks to what's necessary in order to push back to as well. I mean, I think that so much about this coalition, right, this and the kind of reaching out to different organizations and expanding the kind of, the roots, if you will, right, of this movement and this pushing back is basically also saying, like, yeah, look, we can't do this on our own. Right. Mm-hmm. Negotiating just kind of behind the scenes isn't going to cut it. Right. And like very many things that we see happening in, national politics right now, is that it becomes a time to go big. Right. And to kind of reimagine how we reinvest in, these kind of what we used to just call the service sector, but we can call like the caring and kind of nurturing infrastructure of a democracy. Right. And this is kind of seems like a really kind of important moment. And I think that, I you know, this is the kind of thing I, when I can, I pass on this stuff, I pass on examples of this to my own union, right? And to my own kind of like local union leadership, and to the statewide too as well, basically saying, look, this is the kind of thing we need to do, right? And, you know, there's obviously, this is not news. There's been a group of us who've been, you know, working on this for years, right? As long as we've been there. But there's that, you know, there's sometimes there's a hesitancy. And to see that actually a student kind of driven organization that kind of expands up and see the kind of union kind of connect up with this group and then say, okay, together we're going to move forward. We're going to begin to articulate this stuff. Like, I thought the idea, the whole idea about like show us the receipts, just like that language was freaking awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And like,
keep it blunt, keep it simple.
Well, exactly. Keep it simple. And it was, you know, again, it's kind of tapped into, you know, how we talk, like, you know, in our culture now, right? You know, they've got the receipts. Like, well, you got the receipts, we want to see it. And we will like those itemized, please. You know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, there's such a kind of story of hope and agency. So let me ask you this, is like, so what has been that kind of relationship, that working relationship, as far as you know, right, between the AAUP and other organizations and this student coalition? Has that kind of like been mutually reinforcing? Has it been the kind of thing that's, you know, we should be paying more attention to what's happening there?
Well, it's been mutually reinforcing in the sense that it provides hope, which I think is probably the biggest thing needed right now.
Yes.
Especially during the Trump years, to have students who were actually concerned about this and were saying, like, and questioning, like, what is going on? Especially for those of us in the humanities who like to think that we help foster critical thinking, it was refreshing. It was great. And it was good to see students standing up for themselves. A lot of the times that we're trying to do it is, and again, this is one of those things where it's because we're a large organization, we have people who are tasked with working with them. But also, I mean, this is why we have to get out of that romantic notion that there's an individual hero who's fighting all these battles.
Exactly.
This isn't the Sylvester Stallone movie with Fist. Isn't that what it was called? Do you remember that film?
Oh, my God, yeah.
Stallone? Yeah. You know, so basically it's supposed to be the story of Jimmy Hoffa without being about Jimmy Hoffa.
Right, right. And, yeah, you know, exactly.
But it shows him as this protagonist that's literally out in the streets with axe handles, you know, beating up cops and such who are trying to break up a strike. But that's not the reality of it. And I think that's one of the things that's also been, at least for me, eye-opening. And a lot of the people who are younger in the organization is to realize that it is sincerely through group effort that this type of work happens. Because there's no way, especially for those of us who teach at a regional campus, that we could do this kind of work and stay this sort of connection, right? So there is somebody who's tasked with dealing with this. And so people might say, well, that's not real, right? That's so sort mm-hmm. of removed. And it's like, at the same time, yes, but we're also multifaceted people who have more than just our jobs and our careers. We have families. And also we just, you know, we teach heavy loads. Like at the regionals, we teach 4 fours, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm teaching at Kutztown, yeah.
Yeah, so it's 4 classes a semester, writing intensive courses. You know, I've got 20 student types, so I've got 100, you know, essays at any one time, right? So it's like, this is what happens, and this is how you have to be able to work within the network. And understand when you need to step up and when you need to step back, when you need to participate, maybe hold back. But it's been that way of understanding, like, we can do these things, and getting out of basically that sort of what I would like to talk about is like a business model university.
Yeah.
Because I think that at times, and again, I love the AAUP, don't get me wrong, but I mean, we tend to start to rest on the idea, like, well, collective bargaining's coming up, contracts coming up, negotiators will take care of that. And I think that it's been mutually reaffirming in the sense by having us working with students in particular to remind us, it's like, well, no, it's participation from rank and file as well. It's participation in working with students. And it's participation in even just making it a part and foregrounding it every day and thinking about it. And that's how I think about it.
Yeah.
For me individually, we'll go to me at the individual scale. It reinforces how I work with students and to remember that they are real people with real concerns. And I've tried to foreground that anyways throughout my career, but it really hits home, especially during the pandemic. That it's like, you know, this is a turbulent time for everybody, and college and being a student absolutely does not help. So, you know, it's been on several levels completely reaffirming. And, you know, there's also instances where, unfortunately, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but in the state of Ohio, adjunct faculty cannot organize.
Right. I do know that, yeah.
Yeah, we've had multiple bills that are always killed in committee by Republicans to try to allow adjuncts to organize, and grad students as well. So at the state level, they have made it illegal for these two groups to organize. So this is the way they're defined. And they can't join AAUP, right? Because there are certain requirements that have to be met. So one of the things that is also happening is thinking about ways that we can try to make better choices and be ethical. And so now what's happening at the University of Cincinnati is not just the AAUP, but also Faculty Senate being involved. And being, you know, such a network of various alliances, and having a strong union chapter definitely helps, because that's also the folks who are in your faculty senate. And so they're doing reports now, and they're pushing and making strong recommendations as much as can be made at committee level, saying that, you know, adjunct faculty who are a majority of the faculty. And again, if you're not in the university, if you're not in the academy, you may not know this, but most faculty now are adjuncts, which means they are contractual. They may just be for a term. They may be for a few years because they're considered like visiting. They may be, you know, a long-term adjunct that has multiple year contract, but it's contract work.
Right.
And they're now pushing for, like, we have to pay them more. They're often paid per class. They're often paid per unit. And it swings wildly at UC, where you've got some adjuncts, because of the department they're at, they're getting paid $800 a unit. So that means if you've got a 3-unit course for that entire semester, you get to make, you know, $2,400, right, for one class. If you break that into a 40-hour work week, that's below minimum wage.
Correct.
Right?
Yep.
but then you also have a wild swing where some other departments, they're making as much as $3,500, you know, for per credit unit. And so that's one of the things that now Faculty Senate is promoting. And so, you know, Amber Pemplo, who is in my department, she's a communications professor. She's part of this, and I've been following what she's been doing with that. And it's amazing, like, how this has become without, like, a bunch of rigmarole and centralized organizing, the way that, okay, our last time that we've attempted to try to help the associates, and the associates have wanted to organize, they haven't been able to, it's been killed in committee, then we have to, as people who have tenure, or at least on the tenure track, have to make the choice to make it better and to make it more ethical. And this is how we're going to do it, by taking what we can do within our power to try to help these folks and get them basic stuff like workspaces of their own, offices of their own where they can meet with students. You know, a clear set of standards when it comes to hiring, a clear onboarding that's consistent across the entire university, a clear sense of how to promote within that particular line of work, and even professional development. And just to show you how extensive it is when you've got contingent faculty, like overall, so overall, the university, 62% of faculty are full-time and only 38% are contingent. But that is amazingly misleading, because when you start looking at the individual campuses that make up the overall university, it gets much, much closer in the numbers, right? So at Clifton, for that individual campus, it sort of reflects the overall university. 66% are full-time, 34% are contingent. But then you come where I'm at, my regional college, UCBA, 47% are full-time faculty, 53% are contingent faculty. Yep. If you go out to the other regional college in the system, UC Claremont, and this is a number that I just found out about researching for the show, and it shocked me, right? 25% of faculty is full-time at Claremont, 75% is contingent.
Freaking so nuts, man.
But when you start looking at these numbers, if this system is wrong, it's because people like us who do have that shield of the tenure track and tenure, like, it's because we're letting it be wrong. And that's what I'm really proud of. Yes. And that's what I think is happening, is when you start seeing people connecting across the various lines and making alliances, it also affects what they do outside of those traditional roles of being a union member. They
Absolutely.
Go out and say, well, wait a minute, let's think about this, even this part of the job, as like what Jim was talking about. What's the physical consequence of this, of having this particular piece of technology, of having these hiring practices? Oh my God, that's horrible. We should do something about that.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and I wanted to remind everybody, if anybody does want to call in, we got a comment, got a question, feel free to kind of hit that little call button at the bottom of your screen. We'll be on for a kind of a short time more. So if you want to kind of drop in or additional comments, but we'd love to hear from you too, as well. Let me kind of point out there too as well. Now I'm going to lose my train of thought here. No, please don't. Please don't. I know what it is. So what you just laid out there about kind of pushing from inside, 100% agree with that 100%. And there's a lot of kind of like I don't know, slack in the line, so to speak, that we have, right? That say existing union members, people who are faculty members, or you know, for that matter, at any job, right? To actually, well, how far can you pull, right? Before you start getting any kind of real kind of pushback or pullback from the other side, right? So there's a lot more that we can do already. But I also think that, you know, we're at this kind of moment in history where we're also seeing that, you know, everybody really loved, kind of given all the kind of the good trouble from John Lewis, right? We love to hear about good trouble. But what good trouble means, right? When you hear him talk about it from back in the day, is like there's times when, you know, you got to go beyond like the law, right? Like that means, okay, you have to be organized. You start acting like a union, right? Even though there's not necessarily the right for a union, that there's organizing efforts that take place that are kind of about building power on the ground in these organizations. And I think this is what happens kind of like outside of the formal structures. And I think that these were coalitions can be really important. And I'll give you the example that I always think about was, you know, when we went on strike back in 2016, right? That there was we spent, and if anybody's ever going on strike, if anybody's been kind of the part of a union, you have to do this, you have to know what the law is, right? You have to know like where the actual, like the line, the property lines of the county and the property lines of a borough or a city, like where you have the permission to stand on the sidewalk with, I mean, okay. So there's all that stuff was absolutely essential, to do. And then when you're talking to the media, you have to make sure that you actually have, you know, you're talking about how to do this. And if someone's job going to be in jeopardy, you need to be able to answer that. You need to be able to answer that effectively. All that kind of stuff, right? Which is about what you need to know about the system that exists and then where are the lines to push. But it was also the fact that there's a certain limit of our creative thinking when we are only thinking about the existing terms of the institution. And I will argue this till I'm blue in the face, that the reason why that we won our strike in 2016 in 3 days was because students joined the lines, even though our statewide faculty or our statewide union leadership was very reluctant to like include students in it because they thought it was like, okay, we could have blowback for this or what's the legal ramifications, but the students just did it on their own, right? And they joined and they showed us what a kind of a different approach to joining in, like people, you know, they're bringing coffee carts by, they're dressing in costumes, they're like, you know, passing along and delivering water with this, right? It was the idea that we can expand like the discourse, right? We can expand what's possible when we think about organizing models that, yes, obviously we got to do what we can within the institutions, but when we have the outside folks that we welcome into our meetings, right? That we welcome into our coalition and try not to tamp them down and say, no, we're going to do it our way. No, right? We're going to kind of like open this up and so that there's a lot more possible. Because you see what some of the, like, you know, again, we talk about the wildcat strikes that took place in West Virginia. We see what teachers have been doing, who in many cases are some of the most vulnerable people who have been standing up and kind of fighting back, but they've acted in concert and collective in such a way that then, okay, what are you going to do? Fire absolutely everybody? No. Mm-hmm. Right? So that kind of like organized power is like, you know, it's like the kind of thing I feel like buzzing below the surface everywhere right now. And, you know, so that we have to do everything we can and take on a responsibility, but we also have to know that there may be a time that we're going to be asked to take risks that, you know, we're going to have to, you know, answer that question, which side are we on, right? So what would happen, say, for example, if, say, all the adjunct faculty members decided to get up and say, go on strike, even though they're not allowed by law to go on strike, what happens to the tenured faculty members? Like, what do they do? What do the students do in that kind of situation? And I'm not saying, I'm not asking you for an answer to all those things right now, but as much as kind of saying those things, like having those questions as part of the, you know, part of a discussion ahead of time are really important, right? Because they say like, hey, you know what? When, you know, when labor unions were founded in the United States, guess what? They were illegal, right?
Absolutely.
When, you know, when African Americans went and sat down at lunch counters, demand to be served, guess what? That was illegal, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't just frowned upon, right? There was actually barriers and they had to fight for those things. And, you know, and I don't want to kind of glorify the idea, yeah, we're all run to the streets or something like this. Obviously, you do it with planning and strategy. But I think that we're at this moment, and I, you know, reading through some of those documents from Boldly Bankrupt, I was just like astonished to see, like, you know, the tiering of the organization there, right? Where kind of like we have these asks, we have, it's like a clear sense of we have this specific ask. The specific ask isn't the end, right? But it builds on to that next step. Right. And we're building out these coalitions, like, and we're going to kind of like address this or organize power because together they can't divide us. So it's pretty exciting, if you ask me.
Absolutely. I agree. And how is that? How is your student organization at Cutsdown doing?
You know, I tell you, there's a group of students now that are KU activists who have been, I, you know, had them on the show a couple weeks back now. And they're doing just really cool stuff, right? They are spending a lot of time, with just fascinating hearing them talk about their organizing process at this point. And their organizing process is really built on building out these kind of social networks and kind of relationships with other students. I'm spending a lot of time in conversation with each other to kind of say that this is kind of shows us what's possible. And, you know, they've had a couple of sit-ins, right, where to kind of draw attention to what's happening with the COVID situation, that our university president is forcing everybody to kind of go back to in-person classes. And they're very kind of thoughtful in their approach. And this is, for me, this kind of like a marker of the times, is that several of the students that are involved with the KU activist group, for example, got their, you know, cut their teeth for the first time in any kind of political action during the Bernie Sanders campaign. Right. They had never been involved in politics. Any of this. And when they started hearing what Bernie was saying, they got involved. And that was, you know, the first time they ever were involved. And that energy didn't go away. Right. It didn't go down to kind of the hole of despair or defeatism. It went into thinking about, OK, how do we take what we learned and how do we organize in here? And they're taking those lessons and they're organizing on campus, which is really phenomenal. So.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that I think is unfortunately often maligned. I think a lot of what I'm seeing in the popular press tends to paint young folks as, well, first, millennials, and I think it's odd because most millennials are in their 30s now. Right. But I think they tend to see them as obsessed about social media, you know, and living that sort of FOMO life and trying to present the best social media face they can. Not to say there aren't young people who are like that. I'm sure there are. However, I think that it's one of those moments of false consciousness, this sort of myth that's being bred that we have Gen Z is somehow apathetic. And I don't think that's the case. I think that so many young people have grown up and, you know, basically had their lives bookended by horrible international or national events, that as they get older, they're now saying, you know, we can't continue with normal. And I think that one of the things that is happening again with COVID, much like you were saying, and much like I've been talking about Boldly Bankrupt, is they are thinking about how can we reform things, especially in this time when it seems like normal is broken. And there's a possibility for change, that things can be different, that we can't go back to what was. And I think that, you know, again, you know, to just go back to the idea that it's young folks, and in particular, it's led by women and it's led by people of color, right, who are really saying we're not going back to what was before. And that's, I think that's where I find hope. And I find, you know, again, that idea of each one teach one is like that networking is possible, that, you know, with some planning, with some diligence, with the tools that are available to us, you know, and some concerted effort, you can really build those bridges and activate those networks when you need them to get stuff done.
Yep.
And as long as you keep focused on what do we want to get done, keep it tangible, keep it material, then you've got that drive and you've got that excitement. And I, you know, it's several factors coming together. I know it's not any one thing, but again, like you were talking about with the Sanders campaign, that really, I think, energized other groups of, I can't believe I get to use this term, but young people, because mm-hmm. I guess now I am old.
You're an old man.
I'm an old, right?
You're old.
So, yeah. You know, that is if they weren't motivated by BLM, if they weren't motivated by Me Too, if they weren't motivated by any other number of causes, the Sanders campaign, I think, also lit up a lot of folks as well and made them understand change is possible. It's difficult, but it's possible. And as individuals, we have to participate in larger networks to make change happen. That this is how everyday folks make change, is they band together. They're not Elon Musk. They're not Jeff Bezos. They don't have billions of dollars. They're not profiting from everybody else's misery during the pandemic. But they have time. They have their bodies. They have their minds. And these are the three things they can use to work towards a tangible goal.
There you have it, man. Well said, man. That's, I think, I just look at the time. Look, we've got away from us again. But I mean, I can't think of a better message to be kind of like closing out tonight on. Is like, absolutely. I mean, you couldn't have said it better. But I mean, kind of any other say closing thoughts or kind of idea looking forward? I'm sorry, we've got the phone ringing in the background here. But closing thoughts to leave folks with.
You know, as much as you can, stay positive. I know it's difficult. You know, again, we can't go back to what was before. We can try to be better. I know it's just, even with it's the insurrection and everything else, it might be bleak. But it's, change is possible. A whole nother world is possible, to use the old phrases.
Exactly.
And it can be possible through new alliances. You don't have to think about it. To go back to Stallone and Fist, it doesn't have to be axe handles in the street.
Right.
We can
use
new tools to get to that better tomorrow.
Absolutely. 100%. And I think that that whole idea that, you know, we can expand our imagination and, I know certain for me, the one tangible difference already, right, with having, Trump gone for office, for example, is that just some of the kind of mental space has opened up. Right. If anybody's listening to the show before, you know that I'm not going to be sitting here and I'm not kind of like, you know, on the Biden train, you know, like, look, I'm glad that he's in office and not Trump. Right. But I mean, I think from the progressive left perspective, we got a lot of work to do. Right. But it feels, for me personally, I'll speak for myself, it feels different now. Right. Doesn't feel hopeless, like doesn't feel quite as wrought as it had been. And I'm seeing it every day. I mean, see, look, what's going on here with Boldy bankrupt at kind of you see what's happening with KU activists here at Kutztown. And I'm looking at the organizing that just seems to be happening every place I look right now. So I do think that this is a more hopeful time than we've seen in a long time. And I think that kind of what you said there, there's no going back, right? That this is not about just kind of finding some sort of mythical normal. But now's the idea where everyone's being called to the task is that we've got some of the most significant challenges ever to deal with, like with climate change, the defunding of the public sphere, right? Like racial justice, historical inequities, like are all on the table right now. And if like, you know, if that whole idea, you know, about, you know, go big or go home doesn't apply now, I don't know when it does.
Oh, absolutely. Especially with Biden and this administration. Biden's just a centerist, but he's also a longtime politician. So he's not going to just take over and we can all just sort of walk away. We've got to keep pushing the administration. We've got to keep making demands. And whether that's through your union or through an activist, community activist network, you've got to keep making those demands. You've got to keep pushing for what you want. We have to keep pushing for what we want. You know, Joe Biden is not the new Messiah.
That's for sure. Well, hey, man, it's been great talking to you. And I want to, you know, special thanks to everybody who's been participating in tonight's conversation. Conversation and the questions have been great. You know, definitely kind of, you know, you're welcome back here anytime. And I'm sure they're going to be bugging you in the future, too, as well. As we see, it's like I think I hit a critical mass of like, you know, like of following your Twitter feed. I'm like, OK, now it's time to have back on because this just puts it over the top. Dead people teaching. OK, come on. We're going to keep
Zombie professors teaching art history.
There you go. Well, hey, man, I appreciate you so much coming on. I appreciate you taking the time. And everybody out there, I want to remind you that if you want to help support this show, you can become a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/RC Press. Or if you're listening live on Podbean right now, what you can do is hit that little kind of gift button at the bottom of your app and just kind of leave us a couple bucks in our tip jar by sending us a gift. Special thanks, you know, goes out to Whatev2070 for the gift that she sent today. And you know, support your local progressive media too as well. I mean, we need to build out our infrastructure in every single way. If you're listening on YouTube or you want to go check out our YouTube channel, or go look under for Raging Chicken or just search for Out to Coop Podcast, make sure you hit over there and hit that subscribe button, hit that little bell. So every time we go live, that you know what's going to happen, you can join the conversation. So special thanks once again to Brian Bailey, coming us from UC. I appreciate you taking the time, Brian.
Hey, no, thank you for having me. And again, I'm glad people are listening. I think this is important, you know, to have these spaces where we can talk about the stuff and you don't feel alone and realize that you're not alone.
Hear, hear, man. Hear, hear.
All right. Solidarity, brother.
Solidarity, brother. All right. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. I'm going to go out once again with the awesome Jonathan Mann on my soundboard that seems to be having some issues this evening, but I'm going to see if we can get him to play us out anyways. Here he is, Jonathan Mann, everybody. See ya!